Third case of the day, Wilson against McRae's. Mr. Burt.
May it please the court. I am Marshall Burt, and I represent the appellant Mark Wilson. Wilson appeals a summary judgment entered against him by the district court on his civil rights claims brought under Section 1983 and 1982 arising from his shoplifting arrest at Carson's. This arrest occurred despite him having a receipt for the merchandise they claim he stole. He also appeals the dismissal of a state law claim for lack of jurisdiction. It is clear that this court will reverse a summary judgment entered by a district court if the record contains disputed issues of material fact. Every material fact in this case was disputed between the parties. Most important was the fact that the police arrested Wilson at Carson's direction without conducting an independent investigation and despite their knowledge that Wilson had a receipt for the merchandise. In dismissing Wilson's 1983 claim, the district court erroneously held that the police failed to conduct an independent investigation in his case was irrelevant, and instead held that the police had a custom and routine of conducting an independent investigation by reviewing the evidence. This finding is a direct violation of the summary judgment standards because it accepted Carson's conclusory statements of routine and practice of the police without any basis whatsoever, without any foundation, and the fact that Wilson's evidence rebutted each of the claims of practice and routine. For instance, the district court expressly held that the police routinely interview the suspects. In this case, Wilson testified that they never interviewed him. The district court held...
Why are those things inconsistent?
They're inconsistent because Wilson...
Suppose I make the proposition that a given coin is loaded and it comes up heads 9 times out of 10, and somebody else testifies that on a given throw it came up tails. Would that suggest that there was any error in the initial proposition that it come up heads 9 times out of 10?
In this case, we're talking summary judgment,
Your
Honor.
I'm asking a particular question,
okay,
which you have to answer that question rather than talk about this case, which has nothing to do with coins, heads, tails, right?
A coin can come up heads or it can come up tails, and I agree with that. But the inference here has to go to Wilson, and if they did not interview him, then the inference goes that they did not interview anyone else because they had no facts to support that they routinely interviewed anyone else. In fact, when we asked...
Other than their testimony, which is a fact, let me put it a different way. Was there any evidence in this case from other people who had been arrested about what happened in those arrests?
No.
Because the best way of contradicting a claim that what the norm is X is to collect some other instances, right? In my coin example, if you wanted to show that the coin was a fair one rather than a loaded one, you would flip it 20 times rather than just look at one. That's what leads to my question. Was there any effort to look at other instances to see what the norm was?
No, there was no other evidence to look at what the norm was. The only evidence that was introduced was what happened in Wilson's case. And Wilson is one who is claiming that the police violated his civil rights by not conducting an independent investigation. And essentially, Carson's was arguing that there was a custom and routine. However, there was no evidence introduced by Carson's to show the number of times that the police did interview people, and the police did not testify to that. And there was no evidence regarding the number of times that they looked at the surveillance tapes. And in this case, we know that they did not look at the surveillance tape in his instance. And if the police are trying to introduce evidence of custom and routine, the burden is on them under Rule 406. It's not on Wilson. And again, this is a summary judgment motion where they have to prove that there are no disputed issues of material fact. And we've established that, at least in Wilson's case, they did not do what they claim that they always do. And this serves as an inference that they violated his civil rights. Carson, however, now somewhat changes his argument and says that the failure to investigate must be pursuant to a prearranged customary plan. However, the evidence shows that was not argued below, and more importantly, it's not the law. The law in this circuit is simply that a private citizen may be considered a state actor for any number of reasons, one of which if they acted together with the state or they obtained significant aid from the state. And a prearranged customary plan is not...
Let me try a different version of this question.
Okay.
What element of proof do you think was established on this record that was not established in the Graminos record?
Your Honor, first of all, Carson has not relied on Graminos, but to answer your question, what was established here was that the police did not conduct an independent investigation in Graminos.
That was also established in Graminos. That was Mr. Graminos's major claim. Now, I'm asking what was established here that was different from what was established in Graminos.
I would say, to answer your question, the most important element of proof was that we actually had exculpatory evidence. Wilson had in his presence a receipt which matched the merchandise. And in Graminos, the police had conflicting views. And in light of those conflicting views, they had to accept one of them.
The gist of my question is not, was the arrest good or not? It had to do with the state action inquiry. So I will try to focus the question more. What issue pertinent to the state action question differentiates your case from Graminos?
I believe in this case, we have the police, two police officers who customarily and typically respond to the shoplifting incident at Carson. We don't know if that existed in Graminos, if it was the same two police officers. So these two police officers typically responded to the shoplifting incident, and they also arrested him without speaking to him, and at Carson's insistence. And in fact, the police officer here testified that they arrested him because the receipt was not any good. But also a distinguishing feature here is that the police testified that they did not recall any incident where they did not arrest anyone that Carson wanted arrested. And that is also goes toward whether the police were acting on their own or whether they were simply a surrogate of Carson's. And these facts that we have presented in the record show that the police were simply acting...
Counsel, let me put you a somewhat related hypothetical. Suppose somebody is arrested on an arrest warrant, and the defendant offers to show that the magistrate in question had signed all of the warrant applications presented over the past 12 months. The police ask for 100 warrants, the magistrate signs 100. Would that be evidence that the magistrate had not exercised independent judgment? Would that allow us to disregard the warrant?
I do not believe so, Your Honor. I think it would show that without more facts, we could not say whether the magistrate exercised independent judgment.
There'd be two hypotheses. One is that the magistrate will sign anything put before him, and the other is that the police only put before the magistrate cases where there's probable cause. And we have the same two hypotheses for what happens of shoplifting arrests Carson.
Yes.
One hypothesis is the police will arrest anybody Carson's asked for. Then we've got a state action issue. The other hypothesis is that Carson's has in the past put forward only people for whom there's probable cause. How would we differentiate these two possibilities? Well, one way of differentiating them might be to look at what happens. Take a sample of these 20 arrests and see how many of them end in convictions or civil settlements or something like that. Was that done?
That was not done, Your Honor.
Do we have any information about what happened to the other arrests?
No, we do not. There's nothing in the record on that.
But then aren't we in this fix? We can't differentiate the two major hypotheses?
Well, one of the ways we can distinguish them is the fact of whether there was exculpatory evidence. And one of that, the exculpatory evidence that's present in this case is the fact that he has a receipt. And also, I go back to why we're here today, and that is a grant of summary judgment. And the summary judgment has to give the inferences in favor of Wilson. And if we have two opposing hypotheses, then the district court is obligated to give the inference in favor of Wilson, not Carson's. Your Honor, if there's no further questions, I would like to save my remaining time for rebuttal.
Certainly, Mr. Byrd. Ms. Swatek?
Your Honor. If it may please the Court, I would like to first address the issues confronted by the parties relative to whether Section 1983 attached liability to Carson's in this instance. There was a great deal of contest in the underlying briefs relative to whether or not it attached to a private actor. And if you take a step back, that might not be too surprising, since the majority of cases deal with government officials who are presumably acting, or per se, acting under color of state law. However, we are dealing with a private corporation and a merchant in this case, and it is incumbent upon the plaintiff in that instance to establish that the private actor and a state official reached an understanding to deprive the plaintiff of his constitutional rights, and that the private individual was a willful participant in joint activity with the state.
Of course, the other possibility is that this is simply a straightforward false arrest case or wrongful imprisonment case under the diversity jurisdiction relying on state law, and your adversary says that we have diversity of citizenship and a controversy exceeding 75,000. So why isn't this case properly in federal court anyway?
Your Honor, it is our contention that the claimed amount of damages is insufficient to reach the burden of diversity jurisdiction. There was no ruling relative to the state law claims.
Yeah, well, this is a serious problem. There's a claim of diversity jurisdiction, which the district court essentially ignores. How do we determine whether the amount of controversy is met? I mean, what do we know about jury verdicts in Cook County on wrongful arrest and false imprisonment claims?
If I may first address one of your comments, the Second Amendment complaint made only a allegation of jurisdiction under supplemental jurisdiction.
I understand it. Maybe this is untimely, though. That seems six of one and half a dozen of another, because
yes,
plaintiff can come back and file another federal lawsuit tomorrow. So maybe time shouldn't matter very much. Also makes one wonder why he's fussing about it now, since he can file another federal lawsuit tomorrow. But let me come back to the question about the amount in controversy. There are pretty good data on Cook County jury verdicts. There must be jury verdicts for false imprisonment. I mean, what do we know about the normal awards in cases like this?
Your Honor, false imprisonment or false arrest cases do carry a wide variety of jury verdicts in Cook County, and maybe that is part of the problem. There is nothing in the record that I can cite to you regarding the jury verdicts in Cook County besides...
But, of course, the rule is that diversity is established. The allegation of amount in controversy is to be accepted unless it's legally impossible. So if there were, you know, if we had a sample of 100 jury verdicts and they're all for $5,000, or if we had a decision of an Illinois appellate court saying any amount greater than $75,000 for this kind of tort is going to be reversed, then we might be able to say it was legally impossible. But if what we are is in a state of ignorance about what awards for these kinds of cases are in Illinois, and I think that's probably a fair statement, I don't see how we say it's legally impossible that the award could exceed $75,000.
I would agree, Your Honor. There is no way for me to state to you with any credibility that any award cannot exceed $75,000 in almost any case. However, I would argue that the amount claimed by the plaintiff is not in his Second Amendment complaint, does not amount to the jurisdictional limit. Returning, if Your Honor, if I could address the allegations under Section 1982. Judge Manning granted summary judgment under Section 1982 and held that ruling applied to any forthcoming allegations under Section 1981. And it is the defendant's contention that racial animus has not been established by the plaintiff in this case. Plaintiff cites only to three elements of racial animus in support of his argument. All three elements are insufficient to reach his burden of proof. The first element is a racially insensitive remark, which is remarkably similar to the facts in Chavez. In Chavez, one of the plaintiffs was involved in an arrest involving three police officers. One of those police officers stated to him that you can never tell with people like you. Mark Wilson, in this case, was involved in an arrest involving three loss prevention agents. Only one of those agents has been alleged to state a racially insensitive remark. He is alleged to have stated or referred to Mr. Wilson as homie during the course of the detention.
Does Carson's keep data on what happens in these prosecutions? I mean, Carson's must charge decent numbers of people with shoplifting.
Yes, sir.
Does it keep data on what happens in the ensuing prosecutions?
I cannot state that with any certainty.
There's apparently none in this record.
That would be true.
Because it would be interesting to know, and the parties haven't given it to us, so there's no place to go. It would be interesting to know what the success rates are. You see, the plaintiff's claim of racial discrimination implies that there's a lower conviction rate for blacks arrested for shoplifting at the Carson store than there is for whites arrested for shoplifting. The charges are being leveled recklessly against blacks.
Correct.
That would have clear traces in the outcomes of these prosecutions.
Correct.
It would sure would be nice to know what it is, but if it's not here, nothing we can do. Okay.
That would go to the second element, the statistical evidence presented to the court. And I would remark that Chavez stated that without any reliability of statistics and additional evidence of racial animus, statistics are insufficient to establish racial animus. But returning to the insensitive remark allegedly made by Muhammad Yazin, as in Chavez, there is no allegation that the remaining loss prevention agents made any racially insensitive remark. And in fact, the racially insensitive remark being alleged in this case has a lower significance than that in Chavez, as it makes no indication as to why this individual was detained by Carson's, as opposed to the comment in Chavez, you just never know with people like you. The last evidence regarding racial animus presented by the plaintiff is the allegation that Carson's continued the detention and continued with the process of the arrest despite the alleged production of a receipt. The only support that this is evidence of racial animus presented by the plaintiff is the case of Thomas versus Topps Friendly Market, a case where it is completely distinguishable from the facts of this case. In the first instance, that was a grant, that involved a grant of a motion to dismiss. Also, it is a district court case out of New York. But more importantly, in that case, there was evidence that there was public accusation of the theft in front of individuals outside the store or outside the store's employ, and also that the individual was forcibly restrained to the point where his clothing was torn. There is no evidence of a forcible restraint in this instance. Further, there's evidence that the individual was watched and followed from the time he entered the store, something that is not present in this case, and that he was the only person of color within the store at the time. If there are no further questions, I will sit down, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Counsel. Anything further, Mr. Byrd?
Your Honor, Carson's is arguing that the 1982 claim fails because we failed to present evidence of racial animus. However, when they filed their motion for summary judgment, they never argued racial animus. It was essentially conceded. In the district court's opinion, the court never addressed racial animus. Carson's has a burden of proving that there's a lack of a genuine issue of material fact when they're filing their motion for summary judgment. They are supposed to point out each of the items that lack dispute. It's clearly disputed here the issue of racial animus, but they never raised it in their motion for summary judgment, and it was never part of the record on the district court's summary judgment opinion. The only time racial animus ever came up in this case was in Carson's response to Wilson's motion to vacate, and that was only one sentence. The district court held, in denying our motion to vacate, that Wilson failed to prove that the sheets belonged to him, which was an enumerated act, as well as racial animus. We, obviously, who owned the sheets is a disputed issue of fact, and the only issue on summary judgment was whether he satisfied a violation of an enumerated act. So there's a disputed issue of whether he owned the sheet, and the whole issue of racial animus was not a part of the court's record. Now, Carson's attempts to say that, well, it was fair for the district court to address racial animus because they can raise it sua sponte, and as long as the party has notice and an opportunity to be heard. But summary judgment had already been granted. Wilson never had notice and an opportunity to be heard, and he never had an opportunity to introduce all the evidence relating to his racial animus claim. However, as the record stands, we certainly do have sufficient evidence to support a claim for racial animus, even though it was not properly preserved below. However, this court need not address the issue of racial animus because it was not part of the summary judgment. The only issue on summary judgment was whether...
I think we have your position on that.
Okay.
Let me ask you about the jurisdictional issue. Is there any reason why it matters whether this is the case in which you raise your claim under the diversity jurisdiction, or whether it's done in another case that you could file tomorrow morning?
It should not matter, Your Honor, other than the fact of...
If it doesn't matter, then why shouldn't we enforce the rule that if you plead in your complaint that the only jurisdiction over the state claims is the supplemental jurisdiction, that's that?
Well, procedurally, it wouldn't matter...
Why should we allow this to be raised on a post-judgment motion?
One reason, Your Honor, is it's an old case. All the discovery had been done in this case. The district court was familiar with the case.
Completely irrelevant. The discovery has been done, and therefore it won't have to be redone if you file another complaint tomorrow morning.
Your Honor, but we would not. I mean, all the issues were addressed by the district court. The district court is familiar with the case, and...
I'm puzzled by your insistence on that. You have your choice between a district judge who thinks you've got a bum case and a new district judge drawn at random, and you're insisting on having it sent back to the district judge who thinks you have a bum case. Is that a normal thing for a plaintiff to want?
I think, Your Honor, that we may actually go back to Judge Manning, though, because... One, I don't think we draw a new judge. I think we would go back to her.
Unrelated case theory?
I believe so, Your Honor, because on the civil cover sheets we have to put down whether it was previously dismissed by the court. I'm not absolutely certain whether we would go back to Judge Manning, but my suspicion would be that we would. So we would still end up before Judge Manning. And you're right, though, Your Honor, it's six, one half dozen of another. So there's not a...
Okay.
I see my time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement. Our next case...